Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this week are a couple who are passionate about politics. Pat Carroll is originally from Dundalk in County Louth and became involved in the Labour Party during the 1969 general election campaign. Through his involvement in the party, he met his future wife and they will be 38 years married this year. Joan Burton is from Dublin and was first elected to the Dáil in 1992. She is deputy leader of the Labour Party and was appointed Minister for Social Protection in March 2011. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Pat, where did you meet your future wife?
Well, it was through the Labour Party involvement, really. An occasion arose in October Labour Party conference of 1973, where I was promoting a debate about natural resources, oil, gas and minerals, because I was involved in an organisation called Resources Protection Campaign, which was highlighting the exploitation of Irish natural resources. And Noel Brown was to propose a resolution at the conference, but he needed to be nominated as a delegate by a branch. And I had heard that there was a branch in Stonybatter that was prepared to do so. But Noel sent me over to negotiate the details, as it were. So Joan was the secretary of the branch, and I met her there for the first time. And little did I know that when I was trying to find out where Stonybatter was, although I was teaching at the time in the College of Technology in Bolton Street, I certainly wasn't aware that going on my bicycle that evening that I would be doing it a lot more often in the months and years to come.
Do you remember him coming looking for you in relation to that?
I do, because the weather was particularly foul at the time. It was really raining and lashing, and I think Pat was pretty well drenched from the bike. And by the time he got into our house, which was an artisan's dwelling, a small house off Oxman Town Road in Arklow Street, there had been some internal machinations in the Labour Party, where although Noel was a TD and very well known figure in politics, he wasn't going to be able to be a delegate to the conference. So I wasn't long enough in the Labour Party to qualify to be a delegate. So I can say that Noel Brown took my place. And we struck up a friendship, and the friendship then turned into a romance, and here we still are. And I have to say, it has been great.
But didn't you get married quite quickly? In other words, you didn't know each other that long.
No.
Not particularly. We got married
in 1975.
Yeah.
How many months? Was it less than a year?
Almost? Less than a year.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm somebody for making up my mind. And I think Pat is too. And we made up our mind. And so we got married. And I don't think... Well, sorry, I'll speak for myself. I haven't regretted it. You better ask Pat.
No, I can see he hasn't. But at what stage did it go from, say, a friendship to a romance? A
couple of months, really.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I know I was sharing a flat with some friends, and they identified very quickly that the tone of my voice talking about this woman that I had met had changed quite dramatically, from the normal, as it were, political. And, you know, certainly one of my closest friends said to me, "There's something happening there."
And I don't think it was just about politics. I was one of these people who was into reading all the great novels. And I have a lifelong obsession with going to the pictures, as it was then called, and the cinema. And Pat's got a huge interest in, I suppose, in theatre, and has learned to love the cinema as well. So I think we had a lot in common.
Did you propose to her?
I did, all right. Yeah, it was actually St. Patrick's Day 1975 when we were married in the August of that year.
And I remember that Easter we went with a crowd of friends down to Clonmel, and I've always been very fond of Clonmel ever since. It was snowing in Dublin, believe it or not, that Easter. But when we got to Clonmel, it was glorious sunshine, and we climbed up places like the V, and we had a picnic on the grounds of Lord Dunamore's estate. Just hopped over the fence. But it was the days, I think, of Laura Ashley dresses and long hair. In fact, recently seeing Argo, that wonderful film, it really brings back the style of that time.
And I mean, if history had turned out differently, you could be the minister sitting in front of me, because you were the first person who stood for elected office.
That's true,
of the two of you.
Yeah. I stood then in 1974 local election in the Stonybatter and Cabra area. And I was elected and served as a city councillor for 9 years. And I stood in the 1977 general election But while we had three Labour candidates, including the late Dr. David Thornley, we mustered a quota between the three of us, but the transfer ratio was very, very poor, with the result that I was the last man standing, as it were, but I was still 100 votes short of the quota.
So what stage, Joan, did you decide you were going to stand?
I think it was something that really happened after I'd lived in Africa for a while. Both of us were very involved in the Irish anti-apartheid movement. And, of course, neither of us had ever set foot in Africa. And we both just decided we wanted to go to Africa. So we agonised quite an amount about it because I think Pat was very torn. He had been hugely involved in preserving Dublin, Woodkey, all those kind of things in Dublin. But at a certain stage, we both went to work in Tanzania, and we spent nearly 3 years there in our middle 30s. Our daughter Aoife was 2 years old, and in many ways I suppose it certainly changed the course of my life, because certainly when I came back I would never have seen myself as being involved in running for politics, but when I came back I felt rather differently.
You have to remember that the Labour Party presented itself very much as a champion of women's rights in many things. But there wasn't a single woman member of the Parliamentary Labour Party, either in the Dáil or in the Senate, in the late 1980s. So that when we returned from Africa, there was certainly a desire among women members, you know, that they should be represented in the Parliamentary Party. And Dick Spring, who was leader at the time, was quite exasperated, but he said, you know, I'm all in favour of that, but none of you women are actually standing and seeking nominations for either local government or for parliamentary elections. And he said he would back them all the way. And it ended up in 1992. It took until 1992 for a number of women to be elected.
Was it when you were playing the truth game in Africa?
One night we were sitting up on the, on part of the Rift Valley, looking down at this lake, Lake Manyara, and we were playing this truth game, and this American kept pushing me and saying, well, where do you see yourself in 10 years' time? And, you know, will you be in politics? And eventually he got me to admit that I might be. And I suppose that was the first time I'd ever revealed it to myself, really, of saying, yeah, that's a possibility. Because, you know, the curious thing about living, I suppose, outside your own country is that you see it with a slightly different eye. You know, you could see that in Africa, there was a huge thing around women, women's participation. And even in quite a conservative, one-third Muslim society like Tanzania, civil rights like access to divorce were taken for granted. So it was certainly food for thought.
When that springtide did happen and Joan got elected. In fact, let's listen to it now. We have an excerpt from your election in 1992.
Come back to Rory Quinn in a moment. We've got to go to Dublin West. First count there.
As Joan Byrne has exceeded the quota, she is deemed to be elected.
Obviously, great enjoyment out there in Dublin West for the election of Joan Byrne to Dáil Éireann.
It's actually sweet to watch both of your faces, particularly yours, Pat, because you still look so happy. Hearing that again.
Yes, well, it was a very exciting moment. I mean, I had stood for election myself, and because of the spring tide, I felt that not to be involved, you know, would be sort of a great disaster for me. You know, I'd been so involved. So to be involved so directly as part of a winning team, and that was a very emotional occasion, certainly, yeah.
And I have to say, of Pat, he's probably one of the best people in the business of advice and the management of election campaigns and spotting trends. I think that's known to everybody among our circle of friends and acquaintances that he's really got a huge talent in that area. He's a tough campaign manager, but he really does the business.
Is your success, was it then slightly tinged with sadness that you got it, but in a sense Did you feel he should too have maybe got elected?
Well, I think I would have liked that. But Pat was very clear after Tanzania that he didn't want particularly to be involved in the kind of front of the house stuff of running for election, but that he was interested in being involved in the kind of policy formation, in the campaigning. He's also very good at the whole stuff of election counts, at which I am unbelievably nervous. That's just a very difficult day for me. Pat, being a mathematician, loves all that stuff. In fact, I remember the late John Kelly telling us at one stage that being involved in an election count was the most fun you could have without taking your clothes off. And for people like Pat who love election counts, I think it might be true.
It's probably different, though, if you're the person standing, because you've kept your seat except once, isn't that right? Mm. You lost it once.
Mm.
How difficult is it to lose?
Well, I think any time that you run as a candidate, and it doesn't matter whether you're in to win or you're just standing on a principle, it's always a shock to stand out there, put your head out and say, please elect me rather than that other person. I'm better than them. Give me your vote. That's a very big act of you know, it requires, I think, a certain personality to do that and do it repeatedly. Being defeated means that offer you've made is rejected. So it's quite difficult to deal with.
As Joan said, you love election counts, right? But how difficult is it when she lost her seat that time? I mean, what would you say to her?
Well, I had to convey the bad news on the telephone. I actually thought at the beginning that she came in, it was a four-seater, and she came in fourth place on first preferences. And it seemed a possibility that she would survive just marginally. But in fact, as the transfers developed, that wasn't going to be the case. No, it was immensely disappointing. Now, as it happened, a large number of the newer Labour TDs from 1992 also lost on that particular day. So it was part of a pattern. But nonetheless, you know, it's quite a traumatic moment, all right. There's no question about it.
What's it like being a minister's spouse, Pat?
Well, no, it's actually quite difficult, you know, especially during very difficult times, you know, because sometimes decisions are made that you feel, oh God, that's a dreadful decision. You know, that's going to have catastrophic, both political and social effects. But, you know, it's no use getting involved in a public argument about it. But, I mean, there's certainly very intense debates on it. I was reading the text of a play recently. It was written by by a woman who's married to Jonathan Powell, who is a very close aide to Tony Blair in the peace process and in his policy in general. And it's 10 years now since the war in Iraq started. And this woman, who was a journalist called Sarah Helm, was intensely opposed, and her daughter was intensely opposed to the war, and they wanted to take part in the huge march in London in 2003. And in the play, it tells of the personal tensions, the arguments within the house, even though lots of times they argue about other things, but this thing was so fundamental that they disagreed that it just caused an awful lot of personal tensions as well. And I was very interested in that, you know, because the theme and the title of the play is loyalty. So it was to do with the combination of loyalty to your beliefs and then loyalty to the person who is implementing a policy which you fundamentally disagree, and it's inevitably that it's going to cause. But it's a creative tension as well, you know, because indirectly, to a certain extent, you can influence the course of events. You know, when there is tension, it's no use being a yes person, a yes man, or a yes woman, even if it was in a domestic environment. So it's very good to actually argue about things, and you know, I think constructive results can emerge from that.
So in other words, you, reading between the lines, at home might disagree.
Oh, yes,
a lot of the time
quite
with
often
policies.
Yeah.
But does she ever listen to you?
Well, I hope she does. Yes, I think she does, all right. But the hours are very protracted in politics. You know, you can go out of the house very early in the morning and not be in until 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock
at
night.
So is that lonely, actually, to be?
It is, actually, in that sense, yes. I do think, now, you know, I take a very big interest in public affairs, but I mean, it can be a very isolated existence, all right, not just for the spouse, but for the minister himself or herself.
But look, you're a deputy leader. Would you like to be leader of the Labour Party?
Well, I'm very happy doing what I'm doing, and for as long as I can contribute in politics, that's what I'd like to do. I find it very, very interesting. I suppose, you know, the last 10 years and particularly the last 6 years with the development of the crisis in banking, which in many ways I predicted when I was in the Dáil, much at times to the considerable irritation of Brian Cowan at the time. You know, he'd make rather pithy comments, but both to me and about me at times, like reining her in, which I think was a famous one on, in the Dáil chamber. But the thing there has been, I saw a lot of this coming. I saw the problems with the tax breaks. And I suppose one of the reasons I would have been in favour of the Labour Party going into government and remain in favour is for the country to get sorted.
So would you like to be leader of the Labour Party?
I mean, I think, you know, You just in politics go with where you can work best and what you can do best. And as I say, I hope to be able to contribute for quite a period of time to come.
And, I'm going to take that as a yes, actually.
Well, at the moment, to be honest, I think what people expect is politicians to focus on sorting the country rather than on internal political disputes.
I think that's a really important issue. You know, the Labour Party has gone through periods of serious internecine strife, and the public, the Labour Party electorate doesn't want to know about that. They want, you know, the party in government, you know, to be concentrated, especially at a time like this, entirely 100% on solving the problems. And internal disputes, you know, leave people very, very cold altogether. And, you know, anybody who's read the history of the Brown-Blair conflicts in the British Labour Party and the incredibly destructive effects of that. And I think, judging from conversations anyway, John is very conscious of that.
Yeah. Well, look, we're going to take our first piece of music, Van Morrison Moondance. Why do you both like this?
Oh, I just like Van Morrison.
It's the kind of music that has lasted, you know, throughout the period of a relationship. And it was there at the beginning and still there.
Well, it's a marvelous night for a moon dance with the stars up above in your eyes.
The wonderful Van Morrison there, Moondance, he is a genius. But look, where did you grow up at?
I grew up in Dundalk, County Louth. My father owned a small business in sort of selling fuel. So we weren't well off in any kind of way at all, but it was a very secure childhood. My father came from a very well-educated family, although he didn't go very far in education himself other than secondary school. But some of his brothers had trained as teachers and then became journalists and writers. One of his brothers, Paul Vincent Carroll, was a very successful Abbey Theatre playwright in the 1930s and, in fact, won a Tony Award in New York in the late 1930s. So the knowledge of, as it were, of a literary tradition in the family was very strong and, you know, motivated, you know, everybody in the family seeking, you know, to do well in education.
And did you got a scholarship, did you?
I got a scholarship both to secondary school. It was a time before the Donough O'Malley reforms, so there were still fees being charged, that although at a modest level, in the local Christian Brothers school. But I actually got a scholarship as well to secondary school, and then I got a county council scholarship, which was very competitive at the time before higher education grants came in. Louth County Council wasn't particularly generous in the allocation of scholarships, but I did win one of them in 1965 and came up to UCD.
And you're a scholarship girl as well, aren't you?
Yeah, I was probably lucky to get it because in those days, the allocation of scholarships to girls came after those to boys in Dublin.
And, did they really?
I got word that I'd got the scholarship. So I left work and arrived in UCD the next day, but I was about a week late for classes and I was just going to exclusively do English. English. That was my really big passion. And I met the porter in UCD, the famous Mr. Kyo, and he asked me what I was, you know, what was I doing? And I said, I've got a scholarship. I'm going to do English. And he brought me into his office, which in those days had a roaring fire. And he sat down and, you know, he said, right, you're going to need a job. You need to do commerce as well. So it was the best bit of career advice I probably ever got. But as a consequence of that, I signed up both for English and for a BCom. And of course, BCom classes in those days were enormous. There were a couple of hundred, mostly men. I think there were only about 11 or 12 women in
that
BCom.
Was Charlie McCreevy in your class?
He was. And a lot of the women, the probably about 12 women, but several of them were nuns. So you can imagine it when I walked into the class, you know, there was a sort of an eruption. So it was certainly, let's say, a loud reception from UCD. But anyway, in second year, I switched over then to concentrating on doing the BCom and got offered a number of jobs, one of which I accepted. With PwC. So it, for me, it was a great opportunity. I think by and large, where I grew up in Oxman Town Road, pretty much probably one of the first women to go on to college. And it was really unusual in those days. In fact, I was back in my old school, Stanhope Street, about 3 weeks ago. And it was very sweet in a way, because they're doing a project about entrepreneurship with primary school kids. So I was up on this little wall of fame, and Pat Kenny was there as well, because he went there till he was in second class. And Nora Casey, much later, of course. So it's funny to go back and see all the work that's going on there to give today's kids in a city centre school as much opportunity in life as possible.
And your own background, was it that, was your background a working class background?
Yes, I was brought up in Dublin, but actually I was born, in fact, in South Leinster, in Carlow, and I was given up for adoption when I was about 6 months old, and I came to Dublin, and for a couple of years I was in foster care, and then eventually I got lucky and I was adopted by the Burtons. Sometimes that's you know when you hear debates about children and care and all this kind of stuff, I found myself saying to my colleagues in the cabinet recently, and Kathleen Lynch, who was in for the meeting, pretty much the same, when the report about the Magdalen laundries came up. And sometimes it's surprising, you know, you've a lot of men around the table and they haven't had much contact with some of these issues. And I was saying, hold on. You know, there was a laundry actually attached to my school. I can remember my mother on my Holy Communion Day bringing me in, because she was my adopted mother, because she was friendly with a number of women in the laundry. And basically, one or other of their parents had died. They ended up being put in the orphanage and then into a laundry. So I've always been very conscious that I've been very lucky in getting a chance. And yeah, my dad was an iron moulder. My mum, before she was married, worked in a printer's, and when I was going to school, and my brother Paul, she worked nights in Bachelor's up in West Cabra to help make fees and just to pay. The school I went to wasn't a fee-paying school, but, you know, to pay for books and to pay for the cost, really, of education. But again, like Pat's parents, my mother in particular really valued education. And we'd people now like Sister Stan working in Stanhope Street at the time. So there was a great sense of political, if you like, almost emancipation and progress being made and people being given opportunity. And I think the nuns always emphasised that girls should do as much as they could in terms of opportunity and employment. It's funny now, you know, I work in the Department of Social Protection as the minister. And again, I have to say, it's like going back to my earlier values. It's giving people a chance to get work, to be financially independent, it's just so critical. And it was then, and it's back to being just as critical now.
You mentioned your mum, like Pat's parents, you know, wanted you to do great in terms of your education. She died when you were quite young, didn't she?
Yes, she unfortunately got cancer of the esophagus when I was about 17. And in those days, I'm afraid the outcomes weren't good. And it was a very, very harrowing disease. So she died when I was 20. And my dad, John, got married again shortly afterwards, and my stepmom, Kathleen, is now in her 90s. And myself and Paul then stayed on in the house in Arklow Street.
Who's Paul?
Is my brother. Yeah. And he's recently retired from being a primary teacher, but he's a great musician and storyteller and part-time box player and everything like that. He used to be one of the people in Bosco, I think, with Marion Richardson a long time ago.
But did you have to mind your younger brother then?
I was 20 at the time and Paul was about 14. So I think we minded each other. But we're very close still. He rings me every day.
There's a remarkable contrast between the Carrolls and the Burtons. The Carrolls are a very quiet group of people. I mean, you could get all the Carrolls together and there'd be a lot of silence. you know, because it's very sort of reflective kind of people. But the Burtons are totally different. They're so noisy. you know, that you couldn't get a group of them or part of their extended family together unless there would be music and dancing almost immediately. They cannot bear the thought of 2 minutes of silence.
So I know that feeling.
You could actually go into a group of them and then there'd be music on and they'd be literally marching around the floor. I mean, there was an extraordinary contrast and they found me very strange because of my, as it were, silences at the beginning, and they wondered where the hell did she meet him? But we sort of got used to each other. But the contrast between the two families.
Contrasts are good in relationships. So, but at what stage did Joan tell you she was adopted?
Oh, at a very early stage. In fact, when there was this unfortunate incident, it was very strange when I think of it. You know, when we went to get the sort of formal letters of freedom to get married, the priest locally was extremely embarrassed at the notion. And in fact, while he was saying, oh, there's no problem about that at all, but it was quite clearly in his demeanour that it was a matter of enormous embarrassment.
Well, I didn't have, if you like, a proper baptismal certificate. I was adopted by the Burtons when I was about 2.5, and I wasn't formally adopted till I was about 4. I can remember the social workers coming to inspect me, and we were living in Rialto Cottages at the time. And I remember half the street standing over me, getting me to eat in case when the social workers arrived, I'd be taken away. So I have to say I have a lifelong fear of social workers. I just didn't have things like a baptismal certificate. So I used to have to do this convoluted explanation. Now I don't have one. And Pat was with me, you know, and the priest was so embarrassed. And then he kept saying, you're very lucky, you're very lucky. Now, actually, that's true. But I don't know, it was embarrassment or it just was something not spoken about in those days. And in fact, in Ireland, you know, it's amazing. There were over 50,000 children adopted since the time of the Adoption Acts in the early 50s. In a lot of families, they've either have an adopted child or somebody in the family may have given up a child for adoption.
You did go to find your natural mum, didn't you?
I did, yeah. It was something I'd always wanted to do. When I got married, I remember I sent a letter to the Adoption Society just saying, could you pass this on? Just tell my mother, you know, I'm getting married. But it was sent back. And all contacts in those days were usually closed down on. In the 1990s, partly actually through Dick Spring and Fergus Finlay, there were people coming back from America who were adopted to America, and they came back to the Department of Foreign Affairs, and both Dick and Fergus Finlay were very helpful in changing the culture towards information and helping people to trace in a limited way. And I went back, it must have been towards the end of the 1990s, looking for information again, and suddenly there was much more information. There was a social worker there. She got in touch with a parish priest. Pat and I ended up...
It was quite exciting, actually. It was almost like a detective trail, it was sort of following up, as it were, minor clues, almost like Hercule Poirot. so it actually became a bit of an adventure. And it was over a number of years, and then suddenly one day we came back from holidays, and there was a message on the answering machine from a lady in Carlow, and she wanted urgently to talk to Joan. And then there was a letter from another lady when Joan was in the Doyle, when she got back to the Doyle in 2002, saying, if you were the daughter of this and this this family, that she had been the midwife at the thing, and went into her house, and she had a meticulous record of every birth that she had attended. And they had minute record. In fact, she also then said that she was present at Joan's adoption, that she was in the car that brought Joan to Dublin.
That's amazing.
To hand her over to the nuns.
Yes, yeah.
So it was quite exciting.
And I've met a lot of, obviously, older women, and, you know, a lot of regrets. You know, people are so thrilled nowadays that people keep their children and just saying, look, the times were like that. They were so difficult. They were so hard. And, you know, people, I've had quite a number of people really weeping a lot and saying, how did we do that? How did that happen? We didn't fully know. That was what was good for people.
Sadly, though, your mum was dead.
She was, yeah, yeah, yeah. I met her two brothers. One of them died shortly after I met him, and the other died. He's dead more than a year now. And I also met her first cousin in America, a woman in America. And
so, who was your natural mother?
She was a farmer, a sheep farmer. My dad was, well, I'm told, was her cousin, and he was another farmer. And I think it wasn't the custom then for cousins to marry very often. Very well spoken of by everybody who knew her. And the funny thing was, when we finally met the parish priest in the area where they lived, he just said, this is not possible. And he said, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to trace it. And when we met him then a couple of months later, because the searching is quite a slow process, he said, it's amazing. The first three people I asked said, did you not know that?
Only in Ireland.
It was an amazing moment.
So it was one of those things, like a lot of things in Ireland, that everybody knew in relation to adoption, and nobody knew specifically.
What were you saying, Paul?
There was an amazing moment when our own daughter met Joan's uncle. He was very old. He must have been 85, 86 at the time. But when Aoife walked into the room, he almost recognised his sister. And he burst into tears. It was that kind of recognition, you know, because he could remember a young woman and Aoife, as it were, very, very like her. And that was a highly emotional moment for him, and obviously for us
for
as well.
All of you.
My adopted family have been wonderful to me. The Burtons and the Houlihans, as Pat has said, and the Kings, they've been such tremendous people, very artistic, very musical, very, very lively people. In fact, I think the most bitter disappointment for all of them was that I couldn't sing properly, because they're all wonderful singers. And I think that's the norm. Most adopted families love the children that they adopt to bits. But there is this other side of somebody wanting to explore their original identity. It doesn't in any way replace your adopted family. It's just the part of the story of who somebody is. And that's why I still meet a lot of people doing tracing. And, you know, if I can, I just maybe tell them a little bit about my own story.
And do you think it did mean a lot to you even as a family, that in the end you found out who your natural parents were.
Yes.
Do you think it made a difference?
I think it made a huge difference, actually. And I also found, you know, that the people I met in the course of this search were really interesting people, because it did mean going across to the United States on a couple of occasions to meet and to sort of, as it were, find out more.
And, of course, the irony was that when I was a small child, the one thing I remember being told by my adopted mother, Bridie, was that I was intended to go to the States. And in fact, when you start to do tracing, usually social workers ask you everything you were ever told. And I told them this, and I remember the nun in the adoption agency saying, no, not at all. And then you're going back and forward, and Pat was fantastic. He came with me to all these meetings. So eventually, after about 6 or 7 months, they said, well, we've found a file. And one of the first things in that was a birth cert issued for me to travel to the United States and Canada.
So, passport, actually.
Passport, wow. I should say, yeah.
So you nearly did
for
then.
The United States and Canada. So it was funny then that, in fact, the first relatives of my mother that I actually met were in the States. And as I like
the States...
She might
have been an American senator.
Yeah.
She could never have been president because she was born outside of the United States.
That's true. Look, we're going to take a piece of music, which is a piece from your time in Africa you both loved, the Miriam song.
Miriam Makeba, yeah.
Yeah, it's a song called Malaika, actually. It's in Swahili, and it's a love song about a man who's pining away because he's unable to marry the girl of his dreams, simply because he couldn't raise the dowry, the bride price, as it was known in Africa, to raise the dowry that her family was demanding. So it's quite an emotional, but it's a very, very popular song. And you could hear it dozens of times every day, you know, when we lived in Dar es Salaam.
Miriam and Becky, they're a beautiful song, actually. Being in government as the smaller party is always difficult. Do you think history is going to repeat itself this time? I'll ask you, Pat, because already most of the pressure seems to be going on the Labour Party. All the opinion polls are, you know, showing Labour's down.
No, I think it's a totally anti-intellectual thing to say that just because something happened maybe once or twice before, you know, politics is an extremely volatile thing now, not just in Ireland, but right throughout Europe. And the current almost totally unprecedented scale of a financial crisis that has affected a number of societies has produced all kinds of extraordinary political reactions, most notably in Italy only in the last week. So I have seen situations and elections which have ended up being quite different than what was predicted from the opinion polls, the Obama being one of them, but also in the Netherlands and in Finland. So I can see a situation where people, although they will be completely opposed to many of the individual decisions, will recognise that after a four-year period, they know that there may be an overall improvement, and they will recognise, you know, that the sacrifices were worthwhile. But that's still a big if. And, you know, it's the outcomes over a number of years that are important rather than the individual crises that develop in the course of that 4 years. That's my view.
Is it difficult, though, being in government, Joan? Because, look, if this is in prime time, so I'm not going in this morning to every detail of every policy, but whether it's changes to disability allowances or respite care allowances or Croke Park 2. There is this perception out there among some people that Labour, in the centenary of the 1913 lockout, that in some way you are reneging on your fundamental principles.
And yet, I've just come back this week from Brussels, having brokered the deal to get the European Union to adopt what's called a youth guarantee, a framework for young people being assured of education, training, traineeships, employment. And that's in the best traditions of the Labour movement in Europe. So I think what one has to do is use the opportunity to reform in a way that helps to make Irish society both economically sound again, but also to make it more equal. And the thing I must say that I regret most now that I'm in government is to see the opportunities that were there for reform when there was a lot of money around, and now to have to reform in difficult circumstances. And my own department is a case in point. You know, people are paid a lot of income support by the department and they need it. But people were often left completely helpless if they'd no contacts in relation to being supported back into work. And now the department has undergone a huge transformation since I've taken over, in actually turning itself around, not just to give people income support, which is vital for people, but to actually say, OK, you don't have a job. Let's see how we can help you. So that's the very positive side. The budget stuff is very, very difficult. I mean, you have to look at everything and you have to try and see, in a situation where we do have to save money, we do have to reform, how do we do it so it helps us to grow again, and how do we do it in the fairest way possible? And no two people are going to agree exactly on
and
what
I hear
is the fairest way
everything
possible.
Everything you're saying, but you're probably aware too. But I mean, those moments, I suppose, when Roisin Shortall is no longer within the body of your party. I mean, how difficult are those moments?
Oh, very. I mean, Roisin and I were elected as councillors in the Dublin area at the same time in 1991 and then to the Dáil in 1992. And my vision of the Labour Party is always that it's a big tent. And every political party has different groups in it who have particular policies that they're in favour of. I mean, we've even seen in some of the tiny parties in the independents that they're splitting. So, you know, politics is about discussion. It's about what is the things that are the greatest priority now and how best to achieve them. But the Labour Party has to be a big tent. And I'd certainly like some of the people who currently are in dispute with the party, I'd like to see them coming back again. But make no mistake about it, we are in a situation where, I suppose, again, the most surprising thing for me as a member of the government has been, even though I was very involved in the debate, it's taken a lot longer to negotiate the debt relief. I remember the late Brian Lenehan saying to me, "You are just not going to get debt relief." We shared a constituency. We had a lot of conversations privately about the situation when Brian was Minister for Finance, and my saying, "But we have to, Brian, it's going to take a while." Now, I didn't realise quite how long it was. The Fianna Fáil view at the time was, "It was impossible, don't even try." We've done it, but we've done it more slowly, and we still have a way to go.
The thing is, you both, as we come to the end, have devoted your lives to politics. Do you think people today, though, have become quite disillusioned with politics?
That is undoubtedly true internationally, and the election result in Italy showed that in a very dramatic form. Mm. But nonetheless, you know, no matter how disillusioned people become with politics, you know, politics is the mechanism by which reform takes place, by which social change takes place. The dramatic changes in social attitudes in Ireland over the decades that I've been involved in politics shows that. The changes in attitude develop, but it's politics that provides the mechanism of making the, turning those into effective laws. And, you know, divorce, contraception, the changes in the laws about sexuality, gay marriage and all of that, they're social trends, but they mean nothing really until the law reflects those social trends, and politics is the mechanism to do that.
I think people interested in politics, if they can, should try and go and see the film about Lincoln, because there you are, you're talking about the American Civil War and the fundamentally world-changing idea of abolishing slavery. Now, we take that for granted now, but the film is actually largely about the politics of how that came about and how it was negotiated. And that's really what's endlessly fascinating about politics. You're talking about big and small changes that ultimately affect people's lives for the better. we hope. I mean, that's why most politicians of any and all parties do it for. That's the art of politics, and it's to stay with it, to get the best outcome. I was one of the negotiators in relation to the coalition deal between Fine Gael and Labour. And yes, it's hard for the Labour Party. I'd say a lot of it is hard for Fine Gael as well. We've taken over in difficult times, but the art of politics is to move from the difficult to the better. And that's what we're asked to do by people. And I certainly stick by it and contribute to it for as long as I can.
As a couple, is it more difficult or not? You retired recently, yeah. Pat, so you probably have more time on your hands. Joan's career is taking off in a huge way as a minister. Does that put your lives at variance?
Yeah, well, it's a struggle to do things together, particularly, outside of politics. Like, there were a number of occasions when I booked to go to the theatre and then something happened and it was cancelled. So we've struggled to actually, to ensure a certain amount of time for ourselves and to maintain, you might say, an intellectual life. A minister or a politician is no use unless outside of politics they read books, they read the newspapers, they listen to music, go to the theatre and have elements of an ordinary life apart from the political life. And we have struggled about that, but we've done it and succeeded. We went to see Owen Roe's mesmerising performance in King Lear at the Abbey last week. And that's the type of thing that I set myself to do, is saying this is our time and this is what we're going to do.
The biggest thing I miss is being able to read books. And I know I'm on a holiday when I can have 3-5 books and I can just spend the day, preferably by a beach, reading, and then the rest of the time walking or just being in the open air. I spent almost 24 hours yesterday in meetings in Brussels in these big chambers doing the youth guarantee. You know, you have to just try and manage the two. But it is fascinating being in government, small and big things that you never knew that you're part of now.
Which is great. And we're going to end now with a piece of music, which reminds you of your holidays. Is this right, Pam?
The year that Joan lost a seat in the Dáil, we were travelling in France and we literally, by accident, came across a small village where there was an Irish music festival going on. And so ever since then, most years we go back to that particular neighbourhood during the time. And it's remarkable. You always sing as if you were going into a French camping site and actually it sounded as if you were in Milton Mulvey.
This is from an album, Button and Bows, by a group of great Irish musicians, the famous Maguires from Sligo, Seamus and Manus, Jackie Daly from Cork and Gary O'Brien from Dublin. And, it's a summer festival, so you can listen to Irish music with your little glass of white wine quite late into the night out in the open air. So it just brings everything together and it's a fantastic break.
Well, look, my thanks today, Pat Carroll, Joan Burton, thank you both very much for being my guests. My thanks on sound today to Dave Gibson, to my producer Eileen Herron. I'll be here at the same time next Sunday. Until then, we'll go out listening to Waltz of Happiness.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.